Do another one, babe.
Yes, ma'am, he whispered.
The baby was on her hip, cooing. He was a proud daddy. 32nd floor, watching the savages getting into place all along back streets and alleys. Coming up out of the subway they'd been so busy trying to crack into during all those quiet weeks when it seemed he had the city to himself. What's down there? He wondered in some distant part of his mind. Once the fighting started between both sides, he could probably sit up here for a few hours and counter-snipe the savages attacking the coalition forces. They'd have bigger concerns than him blowing off the occasional head of one of their elites. Big mothers. Headshots handed out all around on those, that was for sure. He swam the scope across the city. There were so many to shoot, both sides were walking right into each other, and the fun was about to begin. Good times.
Do another one, babe.
Sure thing, darling. Sure thing. Chapter 17. Team Ranger, Hilltop District. Forward elements of the main thrust under Ogilvy were already coming under direct fire at the bottom of the skyscraper-laden Hilltop District when Team Ranger made their first contact with the enemy. The savages were entrenched along an improvised wall of destruction that blocked all entrance to the streets located deeper in the neighborhood. Over the comm, the colonel could hear Ogilvy ordering his lead units to attack en masse and push through the resistance they were encountering within their designated avenue of approach. Push on, lads! He was issuing commands over the radio as though he expected them to be remembered for all time. Have at them, my boys! We're almost through! And give 'em hell! Meanwhile, casualty reports and calls for medical evac over the battle boards monitoring the coalition net were coming in fast. After half a block of heavy fighting, it was clear that there was no pushing on, pushing through, having at them, or any other such nonsense as dispensed by a field-grade officer not under direct fire. Nonsense is still nonsense, even when spoken by generals. What those lads were doing was dying. There was no artillery support. The carrier hadn't finished rearming the tactical bombers for close-air runs against identified enemy positions. Some units were communicating, some weren't. A few were missing altogether. And the CAV, operating in the rear for some bizarre reason, was reassigned to check on those units and make sure the savages hadn't flanked. It definitely did not look like the savages were conducting a simple planetary raid, nor did it look like they were scrambling to evacuate back into the stars now that they had been caught by the coalition. If they were even going to push off for deep space at all, they weren't in much of a hurry to do so. In fact, to almost every commander involved in the operation, every commander except Supreme Coalition Commander Ogilvy, it looked like the savages were interested in sticking around for a fight. But even if the savages managed to win today, even if the coalition strike force went down in utter defeat, there was no way one single savage hulk was going to stand up against all the human worlds combined. A defeat here would send almost every Navy speeding here at max jump, and then there'd be no doubt that the Rex option would go into effect. The planet would burn along with the savages who'd thought one colony ship, no matter how big it was and how much tech they possessed, could stand up to the entire weight of the coalition and its several navies. The numbers didn't support the survival of the savages in that scenario. Not ever. Not even remotely. To stay and fight, to dig in, had never been the savage game. They'd proved that time and again in their random menacing of the known worlds. Hit and run, loot, take, steal, and then disappear out into the stellar dark for another years-long haul at just shy of light speed to the next planet. That was their method. They were safe out there in the dark. Too many options, too hard to track. Worlds with hyperdrive-capable ships didn't go out that far into the empty space between worlds. Didn't need to. There was nothing out there. So it was a safe space for the savages. If they could stay out there forever, they probably would. It would give them all the time in the world to get up to their utopian madness and diabolical experiments. But there were no resources out there in the dark between worlds,
You needed stuff to build stuff, materials. Nothing but cold out there, and a black darkness that swallowed everything and gave nothing back. All the savages had was that powerful scream of engines doing their best to push mass between the worlds at speed so slow that, compared to hyperspace travel, forward progress seemed negligible to the point of immeasurable. Travel was measured in decades as opposed to days, and each massive colony ship became a world unto itself, pushing along untethered and untetherable. And unless they managed to get a hold of hyperdrive tech, they were pretty much stuck in place while the galaxy continued to grow around them. Team Ranger, riding shotgun on the right flank of the main body, had come up against the savages' improvised wall of debris. Colonel Marks was at the head of the column, standing in front of the lead sentinel, designated as Alpha 01, when the point team spotted the wall of destruction that had been thrown up just a few streets away in the urban sprawl of Hilltop's western slope. It looked as though someone had taken a massive bulldozer and simply scraped up the street while simultaneously demoing all the buildings on the near side, thus creating a wide kill zone, and then a wall from which the enemy could shoot at any approaching coalition forces seeking to penetrate the district. The colonel called a halt and ran forward to the point teams, dropping down with his pulse rifle as he got close, and finally crawling up behind a pile of debris to put eyes on the obstruction.
"Looks like they don't want us to go on through, sir," remarked the sergeant in charge of the point team.
They were lying just below the rim of a pile of ruined building materials. Around the colonel, the stripped-down weapons team hugged concrete and waited for the shooting to start. The air had that pre-game feel, that sense that something was about to go down in short order. In the distance behind them, they could hear the rumble of the powerful Sentinel tanks, the premier ground offensive weapon of the Hispanian military. Four massive turbines, which howled like banshees when the throttles were opened up to full, now whispered in a silent, menacing, low-pitched scream that made everyone uneasy. Tanks were dangerous to everyone on the ground. The infantry knew that well.
"Remember," Captain DiMaccia had announced to Team Ranger over the command net, "I have five weapons on each of my beasts. A 140mm main gun, heavy twin blaster, automatic grenade launcher, and the right tread, and of course, the left tread. So, please, stay out of our way, amigos. If we smell the enemy, well then, we will turn loose like wolves among the sheeps."
The message, despite the broken standard, had been received and understood by all.
"They're trying to channel us into the meat grinder Ogilvy's sending everyone into," muttered the colonel beneath his nox as he studied the high wall of debris on the far side of the open wasteland kill zone.
To the east, UW interceptors at 20,000 feet shot down through the atmosphere and ran ineffective strafing runs against the streets the coalition was sent to take. The bombers were being held back until enemy concentrations could be identified. Unearthly squeals of air-to-ground blaster fire tore through the canyons of the posh Hilltop district, off to Team Ranger's left. The fighters came in low, dangerously low, streaking through the canyons of street and skyscraper to make their passes against the savage defenses, firing down the hilly streets into the oncoming coalition forces. Portable surface-to-air missiles from the savages streaked upward in response, trying to catch the fleeing fighters, but to no avail. The interceptors turned this way and that, popping flares and dropping chaff clusters as they dodged their mindless pursuers. The intensity and volume of blaster fire from that direction rose in a sudden storm of noise. Ogilvy had ordered another ineffective push. Moments later, waves of gunfire, heavy automatic mixed with impressive booms of single shot, replied to the coalition advance, and replied again and again, until the waves of gunfire drowned out the diminishing returns of blaster fire. The attack was stalling, stalled, and probably in retreat. The dead would be left in the streets where they'd fallen. Heavy booms spat out across the cityscape as armor moved in to cover the retreat. It was ominous listening to the battle a few blocks over and facing a calm wall of destruction, frozen like some arctic wave of crushed pack ice waiting for Team Ranger to assault. And that counterpoint, the silence here as opposed to the cry of death and destruction on every level a few blocks over, was not lost on the wordless recon squad crouching in the debris, or the infantry covering behind the tanks to the rear waiting for the order to move forward. Ogilvy was back on the command comm, ordering more units forward with more inane motivational babble. Somebody had to do it, and he wasn't going forward himself. Commanders of his caliber didn't actually lead real people into real battles against storms of real gunfire, obviously.
"So what are we going to do now, sir?"
asked the recon sergeant lying next to the colonel in the dirt. A long moment passed, in which nothing was said, and all were certain the new colonel had either not heard the question or was ignoring it entirely as he stared at the obstacle through his knocks.
"We're going through, sergeant. Then we'll be where they don't want us to be, which is where you really want to be when the shooting starts."
"Seems smart," remarked the sergeant, whose dry manner seemed to indicate it was all the same to him. Then the men of the recon company began to shed their rucks and excess gear. They knew what was coming, and it wouldn't be pretty. Chapter 18.
"You'll never know what they have until they shoot it at you," remarked Captain DeMacha once the colonel had finished relaying his plan to breach the debris wall on the far side of the kill zone.
"Yep," replied Marks. "I've found that to be true more often than not."
DeMacha smiled and moved off toward his tank commanders to inform them of the plan. The massive sentinels were idling on a side street that opened up onto the main approach that would take the assault across the no-man's land of cleared rubble and into the savage defensive force. The infantry was staged and ready to go. Ogilvy's main assault had bogged down to the east and was now concentrating on regrouping, staging for another attack, and getting the wounded back to the porter for evac off-planet. Rotary wing dropships of the United World's design, their four massive blade housings hanging above a central cargo fuselage, with an armored pilot and weapons officer cockpit nosing out and down, came in from the north to collect the wounded and depart under savage artillery fire. And through it all, one of those massive mechs, at least four stories high and held well back from the fighting, was reported to be lobbing shells almost indiscriminately across the battlefield from its twin pom-pom artillery pieces.
3 minutes from go time and Ogilvy finally greenlit the supporting assault, if only just to relieve pressure on the main body that was getting torn to pieces. And with that, the mighty Espanian sentinels hexagonally segmented, four massive treads turning slowly, grinding rocks and debris to powder, eased out onto the road that would become the axis for Team Ranger's supporting assault.
The tanks fanned out into a rough wedge once they entered the kill zone, and the infantry crouched behind them. The incoming fire started up almost instantly. Squad-designated marksmen and dedicated sniper teams returned fire from back in the rubble as soon as the savage machine gun teams opened up. And within seconds, burning tracer rounds and hot-depleted uranium slugs filled the air. The ricochets off the tanks sounded like trays of silverware being repeatedly dropped over and over again and again. Just behind Alpha One, the lead tank, from which Captain DeMacha commanded his beasts, one of the assault team members who had swapped positions with the recon team remarked,
"They're just straight up shooting at it." Like he couldn't believe that the savages had missed the obvious fact that neither blaster fire nor ancient chemical-based firearms were going to do anything to the forward armor of the infamous sentinels.
The colonel was about to tell the man that the savages were testing, that to the savages, in his experience, everything was data, and that before they could do anything fully, they would test everything to find out what their options were. There were advantages for the savages in being cut off from the main of humanity out there in the dark for so long between worlds. No one facing them could guess how things had evolved, what their technology had become as it moved down the particular path they had chosen, and in some cases, worshipped. But the savages didn't quite know what they would be up against either. So they had to do some testing as they returned to the main line of development, as it were. Like some accidental time traveler checking the calendar in a room they'd suddenly appeared in. But the colonel didn't get a chance to say all that.
"Engaging," announced Captain DeMacha over the comm. Businesslike, efficient. Just another day at the office and certainly not headed into a storm of bullets. and a second later the powerful Sentinel erupted with her 140mm main gun on a target across the killing field.
"Damn!" shouted one of the infantrymen as a dust storm erupted, enveloping the men surrounding the massive tank. This was heard on the local comnet as everyone had activated the noise-canceling effect systems in their comm-linked earplugs. The colonel was watching the thermal targeting imaging feed from Sentinel Alpha 1 on his battle board, while he followed behind the massive death-spitting monster. The Sentinel's round was smart-enabled, so there was some course correction on its track to target over the four-second flight time before it found its first target and exploded, throwing debris up and out into the kill zone. What appeared to be the ghostly heat signature of a Savage anti-armor team of three was suddenly obscured by smoke and explosive vapor expanding away from the hit.
"Got 'em," said the Macho with a touch of competitive pride.
A moment later, without any let-up in the hail of incoming automatic gunfire coming from across the forward radial of the attack, a micro-missile lanced out from the Savage line, somewhere off along the rightmost flank and smacked into the forward right tread of Alpha 1. Sparks and debris shot up into the air like a pyrotechnic display at a festival, and the tank came to a sudden halt.
"Technical difficulties," said the Macho over the comm. Damage control alarms blared out over his feed. "ECM should have pushed that away. Give us a second, we'll feather the tread and continue on."
Meanwhile, both of the forward flanking sentinels surged forward to cover their commander, racing out into the no-man's land like mad bulls charging through a firestorm of dust and flying round, zipping through the chaos of the charge. Their sudden burst of speed was so rapid that trailing infantry were almost left in the dust. Sergeants hectored the weapon-laden men to hustle forward if they didn't want to die of exposure to incoming fire. One sentinel engaged some distant target, roaring out with a massive boom heard even through the noise cancellers installed in the helmets. Then the other sentinel followed suit. Two targets, sheltering inside buildings facing the kill zone the savages had constructed, exploded. Seconds later, the faces of those two buildings slid down into the edge of the kill zone in a waterfall of construction materials and office furniture. Then the ground jolted, hard, once, and both sentinels went nose over into a crevice that had suddenly opened in the middle of the field. The trailing infantry, now exposed, scattered for cover. Dozens were shot to pieces within seconds from zeroed Savage ground fire. When the dust cleared, the colonel saw that the leading compartment of both sentinels had gone down into an underground trench, the subterranean route of their local transit system. The rear section of each trapped sentinel was attempting to reverse out, pulling hard and making some headway. But then the anti-armor fire from a few stories up inside the fronting buildings began to streak down onto the exposed tank's topsides. Three high-energy rounds punctured the dorsal armor of one of the sentinels. The tank caught fire as its internal ammunition racks began to cook off in successive whoops. The nearby infantry scattered and began to take what little cover they could. Some even ran forward and tossed themselves into the open subway line despite the exploding tank. Counter-sniper teams operating from the buildings and streets the coalition force had come from opened up on these anti-armor teams, and Alpha 1's electronic warfare operator was given the green light to scramble the battlefield, meaning any directional or wireless weapons were about to become useless for the next 2 minutes as the tank emitted a powerful EMP pulse. The infantry turned off their comms and switched off the electronic scopes on their pulse rifles to protect against the effects. There was nothing to indicate the pulse had gone off above the din of Savage gunfire ripping up the dirt and bouncing off the bent rebar and chunks of concrete. As the colonel scanned the battlefield, he spotted the eruption of a massive muzzle flash from high up along a nearby tower. He was about to call in a report that there was a Savage sniper operating in the rear when he noted that whoever it was that was firing, they were firing into the savages ahead of his position. Slow, methodical, smooth. Incredible shots of an almost titanic nature, and not blaster fire. As far as the colonel knew, none of the militaries in the coalition used old-school firearms. Alpha 1 was still engaging Savage troops huddling in the rubble ahead when Captain DeMacha came over the comm.
"Forward right tread is feathered, but we can't move ahead until we have something to cross the obstacle."
"Ideas,"
shouted the colonel over another concussive boom from the main gun.
Stand by, said the Macha.
A few seconds later, the rearmost sentinel came forward at a rush. A shovel scoop unfolded itself from along the sides and rear of the armor. Then it was plowing into the ruined debris and dirt, pushing forward a growing wave of material almost effortlessly. A medic dashed out under enemy fire and grabbed a wounded infantryman lying directly in the path of the oncoming behemoth and dragged the man out of the way. Infantry from across the field provided covering fire for the brave medic. Despite having gathered what seemed an impossible amount of mass to move forward, the tank didn't even slow, leaving a steadily declining trench in its wake. When it reached the chasm, it pushed the debris down into the gap, filling it. Then it reversed slowly, raising its scoop, and launched itself forward over the filled-in gap with a burst of speed. The colonel didn't think the gap was quite filled in enough, but the utility tank managed to grab the wall on the other side, deploying some kind of internal spike-climbing system embedded within its treads, and pull itself up and over.
Well, I'll be, said a soldier hunkered down next to the colonel as gunfire ricocheted off nearby piles of debris and exposed metal bars. Moving now, said the Macha over the comm.
Alpha One lurched toward the gap, meters ahead of the main body. It had fewer problems scaling up the ruined far side of the trench than did the dismounted infantry. With just 50 meters to go until the crushed and ruined buildings that made up the savage line of defense, the tanks flashed and thundered with their main guns, showering the debris wall with clouds of spinning micro-grenades. Gunners deployed from hatches and fired into the savages shooting from positions inside the rubble. Pulse fire rang out in staccato bursts as the heavier weapons of Team Ranger contributed to the developing crescendo of chaos. The colonel was on the run and moving forward, issuing orders for his team to assault into the debris. He grabbed the sergeant of the assault team and pointed to a gap in the ruins.
Send your men through that gap right now. Send frags and flashbangs first for breach. Don't be stingy with them.
Teams of men raced forward, found cover, and tossed in explosives and flashbangs before rising up with shouts and storming the positions. Other soldiers stacked around their targets' ingresses and waited for the bangs to go off. They swarmed inward right behind the booms, spraying blaster fire and praying that they were covering every possible angle. And behind them lay all the dead who had not made it that far.
Chapter 19
3-6 Armored Cavalry, fast attack. 931st Artillery Perimeter. Sergeant Greenhill had been ordered by command to get the artillery up and providing fire support ASAP. Problem was, everyone trained on the guns was dead, or so it had seemed at first. Until the lone survivor of a gun battery literally climbed out of an open breach to avoid being torn in half during the savage anti-personnel drone strike. Private Dunnell McAfee was one sketchy dude, as far as the no-nonsense Sergeant Greenhill was convinced. He'd seen the type before. Had been given the choice between prison and military service. You got the serve or serve time a lot from the enlisted UW types, and apparently McAfee had been convicted of attempting to overthrow the government at some point in his pre-military days. Nice. It was some nothing rebellion of a couple of dozen junkies back on Earth. And McAfee, with his degrees in chemical engineering, computer science, and speculative fiction, with an emphasis on Golden Age pulp sci-fi, financed it by manufacturing and distributing drugs, something Greenhill had never heard of.
Call it H8, man, McAfee whined, giving everyone who didn't ask his life story. It's my special blend. A lot of synthetics, which the galaxy is full of if you know where to look, that really gets you there. Know what I mean? Make the world how it should be, how you want it to be. That's why I call it H8, 'cause you hate the way things are.
Kurtz, the driver, scratched his head. The rest of the surviving Cav troop was either setting up a perimeter or trying to find something that would teach them how to operate the 931st's guns.
If it makes everything how you want it to be, began a confused Kurtz, then how come you call it hate? That don't make no sense.
McAfee cackled like a goat, grabbing his skinny belly as he did. He was shirtless and only wore combat pants and boots. From around his sunken chest dangled a necklace of ancient keys.
His wild eyes stared out through crooked military-issue glasses that had been broken and taped back together at the bridge. That was a rarity, glasses. There were only a small number of eye problems that still required them.
"Ha-ha," said the crazed private. "That's because those are the chemical identifiers. It's a play on that, man. But really, it makes you hate the world the way it is, and when you trip hard, you come out of it with a desire to make everything the way you saw it in the vision. It's all vision. Everything's vision. You got to know that up front."
"All vision?" asked Kurtz, who'd literally been a farm boy for some big collective on a backwater colony world before he joined up with the Spallerzan army. "What do you see in these visions?"
"Doors, man. Doors to perception," said McAfee.
He spoke in a hushed whisper like he was sharing the greatest secret the galaxy at large had never heard.
"And to see him, you got to have the keys."
He grabbed his key necklace with one dirty hand and shook it frenetically.
"And I got the keys, man."
Then the diminutive McAfee devolved into wild, maniacal laughter.
"That's great, Private," said Sergeant Greenhill easily.
Now was not the time to play Drill Sergeant Hard Charger, which he'd sent the application in for as his next duty assignment.
He knew this low-speed, all-drag private could care less about the mission or that Artie was desperately needed forward. But he was the only one present who might have an idea how to operate the guns that very much needed to be operated.
As if to punctuate the point, an incoming Savage round fired from deep in hilltop smashed into a luxury condo tower down the block, sending waterfalls of glass outward and down onto the street. Alarms went off along the avenue, alarms that must have been hardwired into some kind of emergency backup power within the building.
"I don't know if you've noticed current events, Private McAfee," began Greenhill.
"Call me Donald, Sarge," said the emaciated private with a smile. "We should be more informal if we're going to do some synergy here."
Yep. "I don't know nothing about synergy, just a grunt who gets to ride around with the calf of this rotation and all, but if you hadn't noticed, well, currently engaged with a enemy, as it were, and the higher-ups back at command would very much like us to shoot these guns at the savages who are currently shooting at our boys forward."
"Ha! Savvies!"
McAfee goat laughed once again.
"Ain't no such thing. We're all savages out there beyond the known, Sarge. Reality's an illusion foisted on us by the Britannia UW Military Technology Complex. Mind if I smoke a joint, Sarge?"
Greenhill couldn't believe what he just heard. He felt himself rise up on the balls of his feet and suck in a deep breath in order to light this little dirt weasel up good and proper, and then thought better of it. He chuckled nervously, except it wasn't nervous. He was trying to hold in both disbelief and rage. And the thing that was making him do this was that every time he flicked his eyes away, like a good NCO constantly watching all his men, the perimeter, the skies, and everything he was responsible for in order to get everyone back to base in one piece, he kept seeing the dead of the 931st lying on the street all about that battery. And that reminded him that he needed the little goat-laughing dirt weasel standing in front of him. He would have preferred to deed any other man from the 931st. Any other man. But this one had an advantage over those other men. He was alive, for now. The fact that McAfee was almost 40, or so he appeared, a private, and seemed to lack any kind of discipline, or a strong connection to reality, for that matter, did not imbue Sergeant Greenhill with the confidence he would have liked to feel regarding his current mission at this particular moment. The mission to get the guns up and firing.
"Well, now," began Greenhill affably, "now might not be a good time to use get high.
Hey," he added as though suddenly experiencing a lightning bolt of an idea. This was all play acting on his part.
"Any chance you know how to fire these guns, Private?"
He added "Private" subtly, but with just enough emphasis to remind the dirt weasel he was still serving in the military.
"Do I?"
Goat laughed the dirt weasel private standing before the powerfully built high-speed low-drag sergeant with dried blood all over his combat fatigues and boots.
I know how to run these things better than they ever did. Yes, sir. I mean, Sarge, you work for a living and all. I get it. We can do shot out and everything, in fact. Just give me some coordinates and tell me what you want to hit it with, and I can oblige with some glorious destruction. You see, I'm all about destruction, Sarge, and all. It's when stuff's breaking that you see the doors. And then we just drop a little H8, and you can slip through and disappear on over to the other side.
Greenhill stared at the private in bewilderment, but he caught the gist of what had been said, mainly the part about operating the guns. He slowly nodded.
We can provide the coordinates and ordnance requests, private. I'm sure that won't be a problem.
Chapter 20. The Wild Man, 32nd floor, Cyrus Gardens, luxury apartments, Hilltop District. He hadn't had a good sight picture on anything in the main assault going down on the streets below. Some heavy-duty financial high-rises, corporate headquarters types, all sleek and curving, had blocked much of the action down that way. But he could see into Hilltop pretty clearly. The savages were throwing everything they had at defending the corridor they'd tried to channel the coalition forces into. A kill zone meat grinder, entrenched positions all around. From his vantage point, the wild man could see the tall artillery mech the savages had deployed in a park near the top of Hilltop, up around all the grand government buildings and the original landing site of the old colony ship. The big machine was shooting artillery at random along the coalition's flanks, just to make it clear that it was a bad idea to go any way but the way the savages wanted their enemies to go. Savage ground troops were focusing on the one way the coalition had up into Hilltop. The rest of their defenders were spread out along the flanks. It wasn't until Team Ranger, of course he had no idea they were designated as Team Ranger, began its drive on the defended flanks that he decided to assist. From his vantage, he could put massive rounds into whatever key defenders he wanted on the Savage side. He'd already knocked out two machine gun teams that had definite interlocking fields of fire set up and ready to go on the coalition forces, starting out across the no man's land covered by tanks. First he hit the gunner, blowing a massive hole in the savage's mechanical part-laden chest cavity. He calculated badly and came in too low. Then he adjusted for drop, chambered a new round, centered the reticle once more, took a breath, and pulled the trigger again, just barely. The small cannon he called his rifle went off with a tremendous boom, despite the integral suppressor, and landed the massive 20-millimeter cartridge loaded with a 1,600-grain bullet right where he wanted it to land. The Savage Weapons team had just sat down next to their ancient matte black machine gun inside their fighting position when the round fired from the wild man's big bore rifle, moving at almost 1,000 meters per second, hit their comrade dead center. The bullet moved right through the body and sent dirt fountaining a fraction of a second before the savage fell backward onto the ruined ground. Time enough to realize its end, he thought as the massive rifle chambered another round. Do another one, babe.
Yes, ma'am.
He felt that smile, her smile. Then rinse and repeat on the other savage weapons team on the far side of no man's land. Better shots that time. They realized it had ended whatever it was for them here because of him. Now, as he watched the coalition tanks and infantry move out into the cleared space before the rubble barrier, he had a sickly sweet feeling, like he'd eaten too much candy or something, or drank too much, or stayed too long at a party. Only he was behind his rifle. He'd had that feeling once long ago behind a rifle, in the woods at dusk, back on the world he came from, Stendhal's Bet, trailing a viper fox that had been raiding their calves. Hearing his ma's dinner bell across the lonely hills and quiet groves, knowing it was late and time to be home soon. He looked away from the scope as I had been centered on, took a breath, and checked the sky to see what world he was on. It was New Vega, and it was almost noon, not dusk, and there was no home to go to anymore. His face touched the familiar spot on the rifle, centering his eye through the scope, and he thought about that sickly, sweet late-for-supper feeling he felt in his stomach, and he knew why it was there. Too many shots. Snipers, real snipers, didn't take two shots in succession. Enemy could find you that way,
The human mind could locate the likely firing position on just two shots. The first always surprised. Details and facts didn't calculate in the equation of finding the sniper. The second shot helped the mind to reveal the shooter's location. Two shots told too much. They'd come hunting soon. He'd learned that from a special weapons and tactics sergeant during his advanced training back on Stendal. And that's what he'd done ever since. Tracked, hunted, and found the savages. And no matter how many there ever were, he'd only ever taken just the one shot. One was enough. And now, do another one, babe.
Sitting here, above a real-life battle the likes of which the galaxy in its modern form might not have ever seen, he was like that kid in the candy store with the opportunity to eat too much of all the sweet things on display. A shooter with a view to a kill and ammo to burn. He loaded his own special cartridges. He took care to weigh every charge and precisely seat every 1,600-grain metal pill. They were too busy dying down there. He could stay up here all day.
Do another one, babe.
He found one. An elite. Bigger than the rest. Then he pulled the trigger on that bad boy. And she smiled. Chapter 21. Team Ranger, Front Street. Captain DeMacha pushed the massive Sentinel tank up over the defenses the savages had constructed and smashed it right through the wall of an old building on the far side. It was an ancient structure from the New Vega Frontier Pass that was being retrofitted, or gentrified, round about the time the savages showed up. Some kind of savage engineer team, they were armed with what clearly looked like explosives, were setting up to bring the building down as the attackers pushed through. DeMacha's loader popped out from his secondary hatch next to the commander's, screamed the Espanian equivalent of surprise, and lit the savage engineer team up with a brutal burst from the coaxial heavy pulse rifle. Colonel Marx's infantry swarmed into the breach, covering behind the tank and the ruined walls, and shooting in every direction within the open floor plan of the old building. DeMacha appeared in the track commander's hatch and signaled that they were moving forward.
"Watch that demo gear," ordered Sergeant Major Andres over the whine of the tank's howling engines. Then, to the colonel over the command comm, "Best we get through this quick, sir."
The tank pushed through the massive building's main floor, encountered another wall, and punched through that one too, sending ancient mortar and brick flying in all directions, mindless that it might be a load-bearing wall and bring the entire structure down on them. The infantry followed close behind. And that was when the savages came at them from the flanks, swarming through access doors that led in from the outer lobbies of the building. A grenade rocked a forward assault squad covering behind DeMacha's flank. No one saw it, and when it went off, the entire squad was ripped to shreds by its needle-sharp fragments. The soldiers of the 25th started firing as savages came from gaps in the walls or from two corridors that opened up onto the space they were fighting in. What made their attack disconcerting, realized the colonel as he directed fire, was that unlike most people, the savages moved and fired at the same time, and their targeting wasn't half bad despite their mobility. "Let me through," a medic sprinted up, wanting to get out to the team that had been rocked by the grenade. The colonel held the kid back.
"You wait until the assault teams put down the first wave."
"We can't set up a collection point here," said Andres over the comm. "They'll just demo the building with us inside, sir."
"Affirmative on that," said the colonel. "Leave the dead and carry the wounded. Follow the tank through to the other side."
Said Andres. "Sir, I don't like—"
"No other choice, Sergeant Major. I get that we're strung out, but this is the breakout in an enemy-held defensive line. It's the only way we free up the main assault. Once the savages know we're in, they'll react and try to seal it, cutting us off. We push now, while we have the opportunity."
DeMacha's Alpha-1 bulldozed through another wall in the gutted building and entered a grand, opulent lobby. Tall, leaded windows provided a view onto the street, and an entry point for the anti-armor round that smashed through the glass, glanced off the tank, and went fishtailing up into an ancient red crystal chandelier. The ornate piece crashed to the floor,
and the giant leaded windows came apart as the savages filled the space from every quarter with as many rounds as they could.
"Buttoning up!" shouted Demacha over the comm. "Good idea," replied the colonel. "What's your thermal imaging look like?"
There was a humming lull in the comm, while the real world turned into a cacophony of stray rounds, smashed glass, and distant gunfire.
"Nothing," replied Demacha with frustration. "She's smashed. We're blind."
The colonel turned to his two assault team leaders.
"Both of you take a side exit and set up an ambush. Maydoun, you make sure it happens."
The lieutenant serving as his XO nodded and moved with a yes, sir. Marks pulled out his battle board and dialed into the ad hoc coalition fire support request screen. Using a real-time map of the city provided by a Hawkeye drone, he centered on his coordinates, tapped out three target reference points, and asked for high-energy incendiary rounds to be used. The response came on screen. "Fire mission online." The colonel waited. "Shot out," came the message. A round whistled in from above and smashed into the street. The colonel chanced to peek from the room they were covering in and saw the flash of bright gunfire coming from the building across the way. At just that moment, another smoking anti-armor round smashed into a silver marble support column and exploded. The colonel adjusted the shot location on the battle board and waited. "Shot out." Again, another massive round whistled in from above. This one hit the building across the street. Smoke and debris erupted from its portico, but the building seemed relatively unharmed. The colonel touched the "Fire for Effect" request button. "Affirmative," came the reply.
Sir?
Whispered the sergeant major from along the wall.
"Any chance a full barrage is going to set off the explosives that were supposed to bring this structure down?"
The colonel made a gesture with his head indicating he had no idea and that they had no other option. 5 seconds later, artillery rounds started falling all over the building on the far side of the street. For a full minute, rounds slammed into everything. Glass fell from shattered windows. Drywall and plaster shook loose and came down in great sections. Some opulent staircase from New Vegas Frontier passed, groaned, and collapsed in a dusty cascade. Dead silence followed the thunder of the falling artillery barrage.
"Moving forward," said Captain Demacha over the comm, not wasting a moment, taking advantage of the enemy's disorientation.
Colonel Marks wasted no time either. He had few soldiers left. They needed to be swift and mobile.
"Flanking teams hold. The rest follow the main element."
The sentinel crushed the massive bronze entry doors and bounded out onto the street. Its main gun and the coax on remote rotated on hydraulic wines, looking for targets. The colonel's ear picked up an ominously wrong clanking sound in one of its tracks. They'd pushed through, but the feeling that they could be overrun in an instant weighed on Marks. There were no savages on the street. The building across the street, along with several others nearby, had collapsed in a great pile of ruin. Dust still rose up into the sky. Team Ranger took up defensive positions on the grand steps of the building they just exited, some covering behind ruined statues. The colonel again brought up the battle board and accessed drone recon, only to be greeted with a black screen. It had been shot down. 20 minutes until replacement, said the flashing message on the board. Inwardly, the colonel sighed. Because he'd had this thought before, and it was a ridiculous thought to have now, both because it was true and because it was false, in a sense. This was no way to fight a war. But when had there ever been a way to fight a modern war? Everything always went wrong. The best plans fell apart within seconds. All that had ever served him was being able to adapt and react faster than the enemy, because the situation changed moment by moment. It always did. That had meant life or death on many occasions. And things were always different with the savages. In the distance, several blocks up to the east, he could hear the ongoing firefight from Ogilvy's force. He checked on the casualty reporting. That was down, too.
"DNS attack in progress," flashed across the screen.
Well, thought the colonel grimly, that makes sense.
The savages loved to play cyber warfare games, so of course they'd fight hard in that battle space, too. Lie low like they didn't want to participate in that space, assess, and then when things were nice and messy, unleash a DNS attack. Effectively, the coalition was now blind. Marks climbed up on Demacha's tank as the captain opened it and struggled out into the daylight. His face was caked with soot and running with sweat. "She's hurt pretty badly, my friend," he said, "but we still got Alpha 4 and 5. They're coming up now."
"Roger that," said the colonel. "We hold here for now. I'm taking half my men and I'm going to flank the savage positions working that crossfire on the main body. Once I link up with the commander, we'll move forward together and see if we can give the savages something to think about besides Ogilvy's force."
"Got it," said Demacha, who was already dragging out some kind of toolkit.
"We'll try to effect some repairs if the men you are leaving will cover us a little."
He smiled guiltily like this request was imposing too much on the new colonel.
"They'll cover you a lot, Captain," replied Marks as he climbed back down. "You saved our bacon today. Thank you." "Well, you know how it is. Brains in the head, as they say, save the blisters on the feet." "And," thought the colonel, "prevent body bags from being filled, which is why you came along on this little adventure, isn't it?"
Marks pulled two squads, one heavy and one assault, to take with him against the savage defenders obstructing Ogilvy. A savage artillery round randomly whistled in from overhead and landed a few buildings back. Its detonation echoed across the hauntingly empty streets of New Vega City as the colonel left Lieutenant Maydoun in charge of the team guarding the tanks.
"Cover him," he said, indicating the armor captain.
"Affirmative, sir," said the young lieutenant quietly. "His tank doesn't sound too good. We're going to collect the wounded and try to get a close support evac off the top of the building. You good with that, sir?"
The colonel wasn't, and he knew that was a shortcoming of his. Mission was everything, and only he knew how bad this was shaping up to be. Wounded? They'd all be dead if things didn't turn around fast. He thought about the special package back in the crawler. He could order the crawler forward now, but the crew of the massive APC would basically be on their own. If they got jumped, his ace card was compromised, and the more this situation progressed, the more it looked like he was going to need to go to Plan B. But he knew that soldiers had to take care of their wounded if they were expected to go on fighting. They had to have that assurance that someone was going to do the same when their time came, that their buddies would carry them off the field. They had to know that. Otherwise, they got hopeless and fatal, and that got dangerous for everyone.
"Make it happen," he told the young lieutenant, "and make sure the dust-off birds have some interceptor cover when they come. We don't know how much anti-air cap they've got around here."
"Can do, sir. Setting up the LZ for dust-off now."
And then the young officer was off and making things happen. Chapter 22 The Wild Man, 32nd Floor, Cyrus Gardens Luxury Apartments, Hilltop District. The series of artillery strikes, as observed from high up in the building from which he saw the assault unfold, were incredible. He watched the ghostly trails of the rounds as they arced out across the sky, then fell into the war-torn streets like dying angels. He imagined all the savages that were destroyed under the collapsing buildings and exploding munitions from the barrage. He imagined this, and it was good to him. A battle, when you were in it, was confusing. Everything was chaos. Nothing known could be counted on as true, because so much of it depended on deception. And you had to center yourself and find out who was shooting at you so you could shoot back at them. Shooting was always the first priority, whether you got to shoot first or last. And if you were lucky and found someone to shoot who didn't know you were about to shoot at them, well, that was all just bonus round. The best of all positions one could desire. The sniper's way of life, which was death for those out there in the scope. Bonus round.
"Another one, babe."
Since Stendhal, his life had all been bonus round. "Think about that," he told himself as he watched the city. There were only two battles in progress he could observe along the bottom of Hilltop. Full-scale, pell-mell, shooting at each other with everything you could get your hands on battles until one side was good and beat down. He'd seen a few other smaller skirmishes go down, sudden violent encounters that didn't last a minute before someone had been annihilated. Sometimes he'd even added a round or two, vaping a savage's headspace like some divine act of retribution, which wasn't cheap for him,
The rounds he carried were anything but. It wasn't like he was carrying a blaster that relied on rechargeable energy packs. He was using old-school chemical-based propulsion rounds, and he made his own. Back on the Sweetwater Express, he'd had a whole loading shop set up to while away the hours and days in hyperspace. In the silences between worlds, his life was perfecting the loads and working the rifle. The ancient rifle, a family heirloom that had journeyed out to the frontier with them long ago. To Stendhal, a place that once existed, a place where the wild man didn't. People didn't begin to call him the wild man until after Stendhal. Living on the fringes of one backwater world after the next, out where the gravrail lines ended, beyond the last prefab shacks at the end of town, doing odd jobs and the occasional varmint cleansing for some rancher or grower, waiting, just waiting for the savages to pop up somewhere, just like all varmints. Every so often he'd do a little bounty hunting, most of them little more than local government-sanctioned hits when some particular person offended the locals enough for them to put together a pot to get the offense handled. But that, all of that, had just been work. Odd jobs. And he'd felt less and less of her in those times of waiting, like she wasn't even there in the abandoned shacks he'd made his own for a cold winter season. Like she was out wandering the forest paths in the night and asking him when he was going to, you know, do another one, babe. But he had to wait. He had to wait for the savages to show up somewhere, following the rumors and hope the Sweetwater Express would hold together for just one more run, hauling him and the big rifle and all the ammo he'd loaded himself out there, so he could hope and sometimes pray. Though he stopped believing a long time ago. He would sometimes find himself on a quiet, mostly dead world where the savages had never been, or where they had come and gone, and that was why the world was dead now. They were locusts. But this, here, watching the day turn toward the hot afternoon and seeing a quiet battle lull as both sides figured out their next move, hauling away the wounded, moving around for advantage, this felt different. Different from those other worlds, those other raids. He ran his scope over the savage colony ship out there in the distance. It was a thing so gargantuan and huge, so alien, that it might as well have been a painting or some special effect in an entertainment about such things. It didn't look like it was getting ready to pick up and move anytime soon. It looked like the savages were here to stay. That's what it looked like. He looked down at the newly quiet streets, at the gaps in the wide-ranging battlefield. The right flank of the coalition forces was breaking up. One force was moving off to the east to engage the savages that had pinned down the main element. He thought about that for a second. Then he was up from his hide and grabbing his ruck and gear, all of it by some automatic programming from an unaccountable amount of one-shots and position shifts he'd been doing since Stendhal. That had always been his advantage over the technologically superior savages threatening to wipe out humanity. Every time they showed up in some part of the expanding sphere of human presence within the galaxy, he'd gone there, hidden among them, and made one shot at a time, shifted, and shot again. Do another one, babe. That's how you kept on going. Sure, you could shoot down a few of them, but then they'd know where to find you. Shoot one and move. Words to live by. Words he had lived by. But now he'd spotted another building. Forward, across the no man's land of ruin the savages had created to keep the coalition back. If he could get there, he could hit more savages as this new element broke off to stab into the savage side somewhere along the main battle down there in the streets. He felt her smile as he heard his breathing, hard and fast as he sprang into motion. He had to move fast, or he'd miss the show that was going to happen over there beyond the ruin. And that wasn't an option. Chapter 23. Team Ranger. Movement to contact Savage Flank at Triangle Square. Moving quickly, with as much infantry as he could spare, the colonel ordered his team into a patrol column. The platoon sergeant had assured him that Specialist Lucas Martin was the best point man they had. Martin was 30 meters ahead and taking them along a remarkably wide and clean alley that ran along one of the main streets heading east toward Ogilvy's main body. Sudden storms of gunfire rang out at random intervals in the distance ahead. There may have been some return pulse fire or the odd blaster, but it didn't sound like the general's thrust was all that motivated to break through. "Probably probing, sir," said Andres in these moments as the column held up in the shadow of some ruined building, or covered behind a slope of loose scree that was once an office tower or apartment complex. Martin held up his left fist and crouched behind a dust-covered service vehicle that had probably been left in the alley weeks ago. He pointed toward his eyes with two gloved fingers, then stuck his index finger up. "Eyes on one," whispered Andres over the comm. Martin fed the image from his pulse rifle to the colonel's battle board. With the entire column hugging the wall of an ancient brick-and-mortar building that hadn't been swept away by New Vega's recent wealth boom and gentrification push, Marks watched the image of the savage Marine. He was obviously on guard duty. Whether it was watching the flank or forward as some kind of observation listening post wasn't clear. The savage was crouched in the basement stairwell of a building farther down the alley, well concealed. Martin could have easily walked right up on him and gotten the whole column killed. But the point man had lived up to his eagle-eyed rep and spotted the fantastically obscured savage hiding just below street level. Armor system just like they all wore, faceless helmet, some sort of cloak, wicked matte black assault rifle. There really was no way to sneak up on the guy. The colonel called the squad-designated marksman forward over the comm and showed him the image. The shooter, a small kid with nervous eyes, studied the savage while slowly working over some gum in his mouth. Then he looked around and selected his spot. With no fanfare, he got down on his belly and began to inch out into the alley a little at a time. It wasn't how the colonel would have handled the target. He would have gone forward. But he wasn't a micromanager. If the kid was good, then he knew what worked best for him. The marksman waved Martin back to the alley wall and away from the service vehicle. At that moment, it became clear what the kid was going to do. He was going to shoot underneath the truck and take the sentry through that small window of space. The colonel crouched along the wall. It was a difficult shot at best. Marks took a moment to study the sniper's weapon. It wasn't the standard pulse rifle variant. It was a charged railgun. The colonel had used those a long time ago and was always glad to see the backside of them. Great for direct fire engagement and targeting, terrible in combat environs and susceptible to EMP-based warfare. There was a reason they'd called them Brittle Betties back in the day. The kid fitted in an electrical charge pack, one shot per, sighted, blew a bubble, and fired. The brief electrical discharge of the railgun popped the bubble, but other than the muffled electrical snap of the weapon, there was no sound. "That was smart thinking by the kid," Marks told himself. "Dial down the velocity to stay below the sound barrier, to stay quiet." In the time it took the colonel's eyes to refocus on the target, the savage's brains had painted the wall of the stairwell. "Nice shooting, Private," the platoon sergeant whispered before turning to Colonel Marks. "Good to go, sir." They were just a few streets away from the main axis of advance for General Ogilvy's team. They sent Martin and three others into a building after hacking the electronic lock at street level. The security system was running off an independent power source, not connected to the city grid. Martin swept the building quickly, moving fast, and came back over the comm once it was clear. "Top floor," he whispered quietly. "We got a view of what's going wrong, sir."
"We're coming in," announced the colonel.
"Copy that." 2 minutes later, the platoon had eyes and muzzles watching every entrance to the building, some kind of plumbing supply warehouse. Marks and the point man made the roof, and a moment later, the sergeant major joined them. What they saw made plain why the main body was getting murdered every time they came up the street to attack the savage forces holding there. It started with a wide triangle-shaped intersection. The smashed and still burning ruins of APCs and a few tanks littered the intersection, as did the bodies of the infantrymen from the various worlds that formed the coalition forces. On the savage side, the south of the triangle, the savages had been firing from sturdy to the point of hardened buildings down into the open end of the triangle the coalition forces were coming through. Furthermore, The buildings not occupied by the savages had been demoed so that only skeletons remained, the floors and stairwells revealed. Any coalition troops trying to get into an overwatch firing position would be sitting ducks for savage countersnipers. The three of them, point man, colonel, and sergeant major, were seeing this whole scene at distance from inside a stairwell that led up to the roof. Within the dark recess of the roof access, as the day began to fade into afternoon, and a gray, acrid, misty smoke hung over the city, they could spot savages in position or moving around, waiting for the next assault from the coalition. After studying the situation, Marks led everyone back down into the dark of the uppermost floor. It was a musty-smelling business office.
"Get me Ogilvy," Marks told his comtech.
"Patching you in, sir." Marks waited until he heard a voice on the other side, one that didn't belong to the Supreme Commander.
"Who's this? I need to talk to General Ogilvy."
"General Ogilvy is unavailable. This is his adjutant. What do you need, Colonel Marks?"
"You tell the general that my boys and I have pushed past the savage lines and have eyes on what's chewing up his damn defensives."
This seemed to stir the adjutant. "Stand by for the Supreme Commander." The colonel ducked from the sound of a boom, close enough to make him react, but too far away to represent any immediate danger.
"What's this about, Marks?"
It was Ogilvy. Colonel Marks quickly ran through the situation and highlighted the forces facing Ogilvy.
"I'm well aware of why we're being slaughtered, Colonel," said the clearly irritated Supreme Commander of the Coalition. "It's impossible to break their anchor at the south end of Triangle Square, as the locals call it. Ridiculous name, isn't it? This is New Vega's high-end premium shopping district. And that building the savages are using for an anchor is the old bank, built like a fortress, strong enough to resist pirate raids, and armor and artillery aren't doing much. But," added the colonel as though he were personally trudging up some impossible mountain to lead a surprise counterattack,
"I have scout teams probing the backside of Hilltop, and we may well yet find another street to go up in a few hours' time. We've pinned them here. They won't be expecting us there when we decide to move."
If, thought the colonel, a there exists.
And knowing the savages as well as anyone could know something that had shed its humanity, Colonel Marks didn't think they were going to miss a trick and leave some undefended route into their rear. It would either be trapped or full of surprises, like being targeted and ranged for some artillery they had yet to reveal. That was their way. More soldiers would get killed learning something the hard way that the colonel could have told them in the first place. But it was clear that Ogilvy and his lot weren't listeners. The truth was, Marks ruminated silently to himself for not the first time within the last 12 hours,
they should have turned this place into a glass parking lot the second the savages showed up.
Couldn't reason with them. You just had to destroy them, and to the colonel, that meant also destroying the planet they'd infected. Because with something like the savages, something post-human and cunning and living in the dark, how else could you be sure you really got them all? It was the only way. The only way to be sure.
"Yes, sir,"
the colonel finally replied over comm, after first muting it long enough to take a deep breath. This was not his normal mode of getting things done. But it was the only way to get things done right now, now that they'd collectively tied their fates together in this, what was really looking like an insanely bad idea, coalition of the willing, as the politicians back home had all been saying in the weeks leading up to this. The goal of the whole operation had been to save the valuable world of New Vega, no matter how many lives it cost. The ones making the decisions weren't the ones paying. The feast was ordered. The slaughter was now served.
"But, sir,"
continued the colonel,
"as you've noted, that could take hours, and having moved as far in as my men have, I'm not confident there actually is another way into the Hilltop district. Taking out the forces at the Triangle is our best shot at getting to the nest. I have a plan, if you're willing to hear it out, sir."
Chapter 24. The colonel laid out his plan, and to his credit, the Supreme Coalition Commander agreed with it. eventually. Initially, the general's strong and measured inclination, as he put it, was to wait and see if his scouts could find another way into the district. It seemed to Marks that the main allure of the wait-and-see plan seemed to be the possibility of General Ogilvy coming off as a tactical genius, if the scouts got lucky and actually managed to find a route up into Hilltop, assuming everyone didn't get slaughtered trying to take that route. But if it paid off, that's how legendary status was achieved. And of course, this would become a political campaign talking point going forward. Win-win for everyone. Except the dead. And besides, Colonel, said the general with alacrity and general optimistic goodwill from his position located much to the rear of the forward line, we may catch a break, and they could engines up and shove off altogether. That'll look like a vic for us at this point. A vic, thought the colonel. Victory. As if there ever was such a thing when two sides started shooting at each other. The victory would be for those who didn't have to die today, who merely had to live with the horror of what they had witnessed for the rest of their lives. That was the real victory. I hope so, sir, said the colonel, knowing no such outcome was even remotely possible. None of the savage forces he'd observed, and that were still under observation from his team located right inside the enemy line, looked to be falling back to their ancient colony ship for emergency departure. No, the savages were not leaving. Not now, not anytime soon. Which bothered the colonel on a level he didn't have the time to consider. Yeah, trigger nuke dialed into max yield would have done the trick in a heartbeat. Still might. There is a question that bothers me, sir, continued the colonel. If the savages do pick up and go, they will most likely be departing with a significant portion of the population. We're seeing no civilians this side of the line. No bodies, no mass graves, no survivors. My guess is they've been taken into the, nest, sir. If they go, if we are able to declare a victory. He couldn't bring himself to say Vic. He was too fine a man for that. The term was phony, like it was some benchmark on an officer evaluation report officers were forever writing about one another. Then we're going to face some hard questions about why we didn't do everything we could to rescue the civilian population when that was our primary mission here. Sir, your primary mission, General, was the unspoken card the colonel had played like an old hand. Because it was all manipulation to the colonel, playing the pieces, moving them around, getting things done as he saw best. There was a long pause on General Ogilvy's end. The sense of dithering that came over the comm from the general, at the extreme rear watching the battle with as much data as could be safely gathered, to the colonel, forward in the thick of the fight, was palpable. "I believe you are right, Colonel," began Ogilvy slowly, as though thinking his way through this new conundrum. "I'll order a fresh next attack in 15. You'll be in position by then?"
"We will, sir."
"Well then," said the general as though only now realizing that the man he was talking to was the one who is going to be doing the actual killing, the one at the tip of the spear, the one putting his life on the line, which, when you really thought about it, as the general was doing in that moment of clarity, was the biggest gamble of all. The gamble to sign on the dotted line, raise your right hand, and bet your own life. "Good luck, Colonel," said a somber Ogilvy, "to you and your men." Chapter 25.